Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second last night of the Vancouver Institute this year. We have today Douglas Kenny, the president of UBC, speaking on the University on the Frontier. Now, Douglas Kenny needs no introduction, particularly for this audience. His title has me somewhat puzzled, The University on the Frontier. And I thought it might be useful to tell you a little bit about Kenny as a frontiersman, which I think he really is. Those of people who've seen him in action know that when he's sniped at, he can shoot from the hip fast and accurately. And that information, in fact, might be useful for the Vancouver Sun or the BCMA and many other people. One wonders perhaps how he became a frontiersman and how he understands this frontier province so well. That isn't surprising either. Douglas Kenny came from Victoria with all its history. You know, 100 years ago it had very colorful people like Amor de Cosmos and Matthew Begbie, the hanging judge, and many other people. I think Douglas Kenny would have felt comfortable in that age because he has... He has, you know, the qualities needed on the frontier. He has a very deep sense of justice, but he has with that also a strong sense of opportunity and a toughness, which would have, I think, in that era, made him end up with equal probability at either end of the noose. He learned about this province, a province about which he cares a great deal and knows a great deal about, not only at the University of British Columbia, not only as Dean of Arts for many years, but also, I think, perhaps even more, from the many years he spent working at the Empress Hotel and all kinds of jobs. And he tells me that he learned more about people there and perhaps more about the province than anywhere else. He does know this province very well. And he does care about this university. And he has, in his stewardship of the university, I think we should all recognize that he has other frontier qualities. That the one thing that concerns him a great deal is looking to the future. Now, even when he is beleaguered by fire from all sides, he will, in the few months that he's been steward of this university, he's acquired for us at least the beginnings of an aquatic center, acquired for us at least the beginnings of a university hospital. These things are things which are going to be around for decades, many decades, perhaps generations. And I think people are going to remember him for those things, for the fact that even in difficult years, he looked ahead like a frontiersman. Ladies and gentlemen, Douglas Kenny.
You want to put that around my neck? Right.
This is Eric's news.
No. As long as you people can hear me. Thank you very much, Eric. I did appreciate the introduction that Dr. Vogt has given, because if there is one quality about me, I really do care about this province and about this university and about future generations, and that all my guiding outlooks on my stewardship of the university do revolve around those main issues, and that in many ways I think Eric should be required to give the talk tonight because in many ways he's already given the talk. But thank you very much for stealing my thunder. And ladies and gentlemen, having been associated with the Vancouver Institute for 5 years in various capacities, I'm particularly aware what a privilege it is to be offered the opportunity to speak to you tonight. Not that I have never risen to address you before. I have, as many of you I'm sure remember. But my function in the past has always been to perform the introductions, where my sole purpose was to make the main speaker look good. I believe I always succeeded, or so my friends have always told me. I would like to ask you tonight to compare in your mind two ideas, the nature of the university and the nature of the frontier. In particular, I would like to think with you about the ways in which this university is on the frontier. I have two senses of the word frontier in mind. There seem to me two ways in which UBC is on the frontier. First, because BC is still a kind of frontier society. UBC is therefore a frontier university in that sense. And second, UBC is on the frontier in the sense that an important part of the life of the university goes on in that region we can call the intellectual frontier, the land of new ideas and new knowledge. I believe there is more than just a verbal or metaphorical connection between these two kinds of frontier. In fact, I believe it is important to an understanding of UBC's past, present, and future to grasp the ways in which the frontier of Western Canada and the frontiers of new knowledge both vitally condition the nature of this university. Before I look more closely at these ideas, let me pause and introduce for a moment a historical perspective. To do so, we must look back to a time in England, the late 16th century, when the idea of an exciting new frontier suddenly dawned with the discovery of this continent. With that discovery, there was created an abrupt and demanding confrontation between the traditional views and concepts of Europe and the dangerous uncertainty of an entirely new land filled with entirely new possibilities. This geographical discovery coincided with another kind of exploration being carried on by men like Francis Bacon. This remarkable man, living at a time when new geographical and scientific frontiers were being discovered, wrote of the problems created by these new frontiers. I will mention Bacon several times tonight because I believe that many of the conflicts we face today, and of which I will speak briefly, were acutely experienced and understood by him. We can reread him with profit. Some of his insights bear a very pointed relevance to my subject tonight. For example, the whole importance of education in a new, volatile land like ours today is, I think, expressed forcefully by Bacon in a passage like this one, where he uses the image of Orpheus' theater to represent what could be the relationship between our own society and our own university today. He says this, and I quote from Bacon, "In Orpheus's theater, all beasts and birds assembled, and forgetting their several appetites, some of prey, some of game, some of quarrel, stood all sociably together, listening to the airs and accords of the harp, the sound whereof no sooner ceased or was drowned by some louder voice, but every beast returned to his own nature, wherein is aptly described the nature and condition of men, who are full of savage and unreclaimed desires of profit, of lust, of revenge, which as long as they give ear to precepts, to laws, to religion touched with elegance, and to the persuasion of books, so long as society and peace maintain. But if these instruments be silent, or sedition and tumult make them not audible, all things dissolve in anarchy and confusion. And a quote from Bacon. Just as Bacon spoke of the contrast between the anarchy and the confusion of the so-called natural state of man and the harmony induced by music and the persuasion of books, so many people find an apparent contradiction between the idea of the Western frontier and the idea of a university. The apparent contrast between the new and the old part is part of it, of course. After all, on this continent, the idea of the frontier, historically speaking, comes fully into being only in the 19th and earliest 20th centuries. The whole notion of the university, on the other hand, is an old one. Bringing to mind ancient stone buildings, medieval robes, and so on. Indeed, most universities, however recent their origin, still tend to cling to these traditional tokens of tradition as if to deny their youth and gain instant authority. To many people, therefore, there is a certain contradiction built into the very name of this university, the University of British Columbia. For British Columbia is a new province, a frontier province, even today. That fact is worth looking at more closely, for this university is very potently affected by the society in which it lives, the society which gave it birth and which supports and nurtures it. We who live here can easily forget that we are living on the frontier. We tend to lose our geographical and our historical perspective. It seems to us that BC has been here forever, or we have. But to an outsider or a newcomer from older countries or older parts of Canada, BC seems new indeed. In fact, it is likely to seem downright raw. The place has only been here a few years. The trees are older than the society. The paint is hardly dry on the whole province. Our buildings are new. Look at the old photographs of Gastown or of Granville Street as recently as 1920, and you can see how new. Our institutions and businesses are new. How often do we see signs reading, founded in 1946, displayed with a proud sense of tradition, 30 years of it. And how traditional, too, is this university, all of 60 years old. Even BC's landscape has a newness about it compared to the ancient rounded hills and the smooth, aged stone of much of the East. Most of all, the people are new. Many of them have only just arrived in the last 10 or 15 years. And what is amusing to many Europeans and Easterners, our old families date back all of 75 years. There actually are some third generation British Columbians, though not many are old enough to vote yet. What is especially interesting and especially important is the fact that most of BC leaders are what we like to call self-made men, though in the East or in Europe they might be called nouveau riche or Johnny-come-latelys. They are often people who have come from poor, ordinary, or even unsavory backgrounds, or have no past at all. They haven't inherited success. If I may borrow a word from our Prime Minister, they have wrestled it to the ground. That is success. Along the way to their success, they tend to have neglected the niceties. There'll be time for those later, they thought. These are the kind of people who have helped make BC and helped make it the kind of place it is. Finally, along with our newness, and mostly because of it, we seem to the visitor from back east a rather violent, materialistic society. Business is a little rougher here. Speech is a little more direct. Reactions are a little stronger. The price of failure is a bit higher. The rewards of success more immediate and apparent. For the frontier attitude places a high premium on quick and tangible reward for achievement. Underlying the drive to explore the West, after all, was the drive to exploit the West. And that latter drive, which started with the itch for gold and the lust for lumber, still persists in the urge for a faster profit, the demand for a higher wage increase than anybody anywhere else is getting. In short, life is not quite so peaceful in BC as it is in older places. There's a feeling in BC that one way or another, everybody goes around armed. In our politics, our business, and our pastimes, we still live in the age of the gunslinger. We still have a frontier mood and a frontier mentality. So far, I have tended deliberately to stress the more colorful and more negative aspects of what could be called the frontier mentality. But there are other, more valuable and constructive sides to it. With the newness, for example, there goes an openness, a readiness to try something different, a kind of pragmatism that welcomes experiment and discovery. With the frontier mentality, too, goes what is called rugged individualism. A person tends to be judged as an individual rather than as a representative of some group, not on the basis of where he came from or how he talks, but on the basis of actual performance and accomplishment and competition with others. We tend to set our own standards for evaluating both things and people, just as we have a tendency, like all frontier people, to make our own laws to suit our own conditions. What sums it all up, I think, is that we are a young society. We have all the vices and virtues, all the strengths and weaknesses of youth. Our eyes are on the present and on the future, because we have no past to speak of. Like youths, we want to find out for ourselves by doing, by making our own laws and our own mistakes, because we mistrust what our elders in the East tell us. We are Westerners, the new people. We are different. In short, while our province is called British Columbia, we are more Columbia than British, more the explorer's country than the Queen's. But the old part is still there, of course. We did actually come from somewhere, even if we sometimes would like to forget it. We are different from the East. That is a fact of our present. But we grew out of the East. That is a fact of our past. So we have to consider what are the values of that older society our parents and grandparents left behind. those places which still exist in other parts of the world and which still exist inside us, if we do not allow them to be swamped in the fast-paced aggressiveness of our own frontier lives. These are the values we usually sum up with the word civilization, the values of continuity and stability, of standards, of manners, style and civility, of deeply caring, of sophistication and accumulated cultural wisdom. In short, the best values of the older society we left behind. The values of back east are the values associated with maturity and age. But these values sometimes contrast sharply with those of the frontier society, and we feel that contrast in our lives. The vigor, independence, and patience of youth are often uncomfortable with the ideas like high standards, sophistication, and stability, or even civility, as anyone familiar with either BC politics or students will recognize. Yet these older values are the ones people usually associate with universities. Universities are thought of as ancient, established, supposedly stable institutions. That is why I started speaking of the apparent contradiction in our very name, the University of BC. The very idea of a university in a frontier society suggests not only contradiction, but conflict. And it is true. The conflict is there. Let us look at it for a moment, just in terms of the effects on the university of the frontier society which surrounds it. The historical effect has been considerable, and not only in BC. The present-day North American university is very different from the original universities of Europe. The contemporary North American university, of which UBC is an example, is actually an amalgam, compounded of the Germanic idea of the accumulation and advancement of knowledge, the Anglo-Saxon concept of the small undergraduate college, and the North American utilitarian notion of the practically orientated land-grant university. It is this last which shows most clearly the effects of the realities and the attitudes of the frontier on the organization of higher learning. The new society's expectation of the university are of a no-nonsense kind, as is indicated, for instance, by the common word for the baccalaureate degree, that certificate of practical preparation, the sheepskin. And that was derived from the West. The utilitarian expectation is exemplified in UB's history by the statement made by the late Dr. Henry Essen Young, the early Minister of Education, who laid the foundation of this university. In introducing the New Universities Act to the House in Victoria, Dr. Young told his colleagues that the first thing they had borne in mind in providing for the university was, and I quote from Dr. Young, the development of the mining, forestry, and agricultural resources of the province, an education that would aid this, end of quotes. This is a frontier expectation. In the old world, such tasks were for technical institutes and trade schools, not universities. Universities were supposed to concern themselves with higher things. Clearly, however, this very practical expectation is still an active ingredient in the attitudes of the people of BC towards their universities. They see no contradiction or conflict in having agriculture and arts, business and science, forestry and philosophy in all the same institution. This is one important effect, then, of our being a frontier university in this sense. The practical and theoretical, the professional and the purely academic are assumed to be consistent and thus are forced to be complementary. Our kind of society tends to assume, in its instinctive pragmatism, that a university education should train people for some specific practical contribution to the growth of the province, the material growth, that is, and should be rooted in the pressing and immediate concerns of our developing province. Despite the North American wedding, or at least cohabitation, of the professional school and the traditional academy, the ancient notion of the university as a place above and beyond purely practical study remains alive and strong. This is true despite the fact that in a frontier society there is a considerable mistrust of the traditional, non-useful academic goals of the university. This mistrust is very apparent today, particularly in view of some of the more spectacular accomplishments of science in recent decades. Developments such as the atomic bomb, the laser, chemical and germ warfare, genetic and behavioral engineering, all these have bred a renewed suspicion that the scientists in their laboratories are cooking up means to destroy us and civilization. There is reason for this mistrust. The consequences of scientific discovery have sometimes been frightening. We have learned that Francis Bacon's warning should have been heeded, and I quote from Bacon, "Force maketh nature more violent in return," end of quotes, he said. And even more significantly for us, he reminded us that science and technology, and I quote again, have an ambiguous or double use and serve as a well to promote as to prevent mischief and destruction so that their virtue almost destroys or unwinds itself, end of quotes. Seldom, however, is it acknowledged that the development of such things has been caused in part by the very utilitarian, pragmatic expectations which a frontier society directs at the university. "Produce something useful," was the cry, and science responded, though not without hesitation, qualms, and even protest. In short, the things which have bred mistrust of science, intellectuals, universities, have often been the direct result of what society was asking the universities to do. In other words, the utilitarian expectation has backfired. Society has got more than it bargained for. We have learned through bitter experience that Bacon was right when he insisted that, and I quote, "experiments of light are more to be sought after than experiments of fruit," end of quotes. Now, as a consequence, society has begun to ask the universities to serve what might be called pragmatically ethical purposes. Shaken by what science has wrought, the frontier utilitarians now insist that the universities produce means to to undo what technology has done. Clean the air and water. Your chemicals have polluted, is now the demand. Teach us how to stop the inevitable, inexorable proliferation of knowledge, more specifically of technology. Give us no more know-how, is the new cry. Now we want to know why. This is a fair demand and one that must be met. But it is more than just, I told you so, to point out that the whole development to this point of crisis was in part the result of the demand of a frontier society that the university serve immediate, practical, utilitarian aims. There is another effect of the frontier society on the university which should be mentioned. I spoke a moment ago of the old society from which we have came, of the values we left behind, but still remember: stability, civility, sophistication. In the new master, he has made his millions. These things aren't the purpose and substance of life. They are for leisure, to be put on and perhaps enjoyed when the real work is done. Essentially, goes the message, their value is in providing polish for the rough diamond. They are the metals, the rosettes which give an aesthetic and social justification to achievement, but which are not really necessary for achievement. And achievement is what matters. In consequence of this attitude, which still runs strongly through our frontier consciousness, the humanities, the arts, the pure sciences are sometimes seen as luxury activities. They are not useful, it is thought. The proof? They don't make money, build buildings, conquer brute nature. On the frontier, there is no time for things that don't produce material growth. And of course, the university, being made up of all two human beings, can't help responding somewhat to these attitudes and expectations. Thus, people in the professional fields may listen too closely to the demands of society and move towards the particular goals they think society wants them to maintain. Those in the pure science can feel themselves under constant pressure to show something for their time in the labs. And those in the humanities and arts may come to feel more and more guilty and thus seek more and more for ways to justify their existence, to be relevant, to be practical. Or, alternatively, they may acknowledge with false humility their supposed uselessness and benignly resign themselves to providing fake polish and sophistication by offering more and more courses in appreciation, sometimes just another word for ignorance without guilt. These are some of the bad effects a frontier society like ours can have on the university. But fortunately, this is not all that happens. There are some important good effects, too. One source of beneficial stimulation is to be found in those salient characteristics of the frontier: its youthfulness, its vigor, its hardness, its courage, and delight in risk. These two, just like the materialistic and utilitarian, the crass and the practical, have their effect on the university. They instill a quickening of the blood, a taste for danger, a disregard for accepted conventional wisdom. These attitudes are essential to the very life of the university. So it's a mixed blessing, the frontier environment. It means that a university like this one, living as it does in a new and aggressive society, has to fight for its existence, constantly justify its aims and methods, perpetually listen, and perpetually decide what is worth responding to. A society like this one helps us and threatens us, but it keeps us vigilant and alive. Let me turn now to that second meaning of the university on the frontier that I mentioned at the beginning. This is the idea of the university itself as the frontier society. This may seem a forced metaphor to some of you, but I hope I can persuade you that it is a valid and useful one. Like BC, UBC is a new thing. As you know, only 60 years old. Like BC, UBC is only now edging toward greatness. Still insecure, rather brash, but full of ambition and vigor. But its youth is not the only reason it is a kind of frontier community. Any good university is. For the main life stream of the university community is discovery. The real life of a good university goes on at the forward edge of knowledge. And this territory is like the West. Raw, tangled, self-seeking, challenging, and dangerous. Life in territory like this can be very lonely. The people who live there are good researchers and scholars, have to make their own laws, like frontiermen always have, because in these new conditions, the old ones don't apply. In a real sense, they live in a perpetual present without a past. The really good scholar looks back to his student days in somewhat the way we in the West look back to the East or the old country. We learned a lot there. That is the world that shaped us, but now we live in a new place and time. The old ideas are not enough. Even the old values are questioned in this new world. We have now entered a time and a place where Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy has come to rule. I hope the physicists present, I'm looking at two of them now, will forgive me if I use this idea in a very general way. In 1927, the distinguished physicist Werner Heisenberg established that you cannot know both the position and the velocity of a particle. You can guess statistically what a group of electrons may do, but you cannot perfectly predict the career of any one particle. The use of instruments and the very fact of an observer renders this impossible. You cannot know. The consequences of this idea are enormous. As Heisenberg himself put it, and I quote, "Method and object can no longer be separated. The scientific worldview has ceased to be a scientific view in the true sense of the word," end of quotes. This does not mean that we cannot learn, that the advancement of knowledge has stopped. It simply means that knowledge is no longer some objective entity out there, separate from us. We are part of it, part of its uncertainty. Faced now with the mapless, timeless, directionless nature of what he is studying, what can the scholar rely on to carry on but simple courage? Yes, faith. Standing in bleak, frightening country like that, the researcher has only two choices: lie down and do nothing, or strike out in the direction your instinct tells you might lead somewhere. If that is not life on the real frontier, what is? What often has struck me in the many years I have spent at this university is the remarkable similarity between a good researcher and what is commonly called the frontiersman. I know and work with a number of such people. The species has certain common characteristics. They often don't seem really to hear you when you speak to them. Their mind seems somewhere else. There is an odd look in the eye, a certain opaqueness. They appear to be looking somewhere else. They often seem like innocents. The fact is, in a way, they are innocents. They are children discovering the world for the first time. They are frequently rude, impatient with stupidity, tend to laugh at odd things at the wrong moment. To be inattentive to dress and common household objects, which seem to constrict and crowd them. They are people who live most comfortably in the outdoors, sometimes literally, but really the outdoors of the mind. They are, as I have said, the frontiersmen of the university, and they are essential. But every frontier society also needs other kinds of people, other kinds of values. We also need the values of the old society from which we came. Thus, a university cannot be and is not only a frontier society. It is also and must be a settled, stable, traditional, concerned community. The university's function, in other words, is not only to discover, but to preserve. Its focus is not only on the future, but also on the past. In short, our job is to keep the past alive so that we do not lose touch with it, so we and you can make use of it to understand the present. By this means, we can understand ourselves, where we came from, and where we are. But we must also try to see where we are going. So, just as we can't understand the present without understanding the past, we can't understand the present without grasping something of the future, of what could be. We live in a constant, moving present where we can all too easily get lost without reference points both behind and ahead of us. The point of all this is that the university is like a frontier society in that it too has the problem of reconciling its past with its future. It too must struggle to keep in touch with the realities and values of the past in order not to become too exclusively preoccupied with a possible future and thus lose touch with the reality of here and now. Just as in BC, there is a tension between the values of the old country and the exciting and often raw values of the new society, so there is in the university that same kind of tension. In both cases, a successful society or institution is only achieved by giving each its due, by allowing tradition and dreams to coexist and interact. In the university, we need the wild-eyed researcher caught up in his or her far-out, apparently impossible, seemingly irrelevant questions. But we also need the apparently old-fashioned, traditional professor involved in his or her reliving and re-examining of seemingly archaic, dead languages, cultures, and ideas. To both, their subjects are frontiers which they can make real and alive and useful to us through what they tell us of their discoveries. They keep us in touch with our past and our future, and thus with ourselves and what we are. What then can provide the means of preserving and encouraging a balance of productive interaction between the old and the new? The answer, I believe, is to be found only in values. If these two ways of living and working are brought to understand that there are common values which can guide them both, to which both owe loyalty, then a way of working together successfully can be found. Again, that early explorer of ideas, Francis Bacon, has something useful to say to us. Speaking of the reasons for discovery, he says, and I quote, "It is not the pleasure of curiosity, nor the raising of the spirit, nor victory of wit, nor lucre of profession, nor ambition of honor and fame, nor enablement for business that are the true ends of knowledge. It is a restitution and reinvesting of man to the sovereignty and power which he had in the first state of creation." End of quotes. I believe the sovereignty and power of which he speaks lies in the fundamental values to which man commits himself. These are both the reason and the goal of learning. But to find agreement on these values is not easy, particularly when there is an apparent conflict between the values which inspire two kinds of society. The values of the frontier are often tough ones: independence, material success, practicality, individualism, innocence, equality, outspokenness. The values of an older civilization seem at first quite different: continuity, stability, sociality, civility, sophistication, subtlety, patience, sympathy, standards. It is only by a resolution of these values, however, that a society can discover itself and create something worth having. And it is to the resolution of these values that a university is dedicated. It has often been said, and cannot be said too often, that a university is dedicated to learning. That is the fundamental reason for our existence. It has also been said, and is equally true, that the most important means for learning is freedom. The ultimate value, then, is truth, the value which makes possible the attainment of truth is freedom. This single fact must guide not only universities, but societies, old and new. And this single equation of value provides the means for reconciling the apparently contradictory values of the new and the old, of the frontier and of the old country. Freedom, in short, is the catalytic value to which the others relate. The seeming contrast between the uninhibited individualism of the frontier and the mutual responsibility of the older, stable society lies in freedom, seen as everyone's right, not just that of the strong or the swift. Freedom, too, provides the context in which various other contrasting values can coexist and mutually strengthen each other. In a free society, like a university, innocence can learn from sophistication, and equally, sophistication can learn from innocence. Practicality can benefit from theory and vice versa. Civility can keep forthrightness from becoming mere aggressiveness. Just as forthrightness can prevent civility from becoming hypocrisy. Experimentation can learn from tradition, while tradition is transformed by experiment. In short, the old and the new, back east and out west, can coexist profitably. More than that, each can be the other's salvation from its own excesses. The key to the reconciliation of the apparent opposites of a new frontier and an old civilization lies essentially in a common dedication to values. More specifically, the affirmation and practice of certain basic values is absolutely essential if the frontier and the university on the frontier are to coexist, survive, and grow. That is what it is all about, finally, values. Freedom to be different and the civilized tolerance of differences. Competition in a context of cooperation and deep concern for others. Curiosity for the truth and the courage of honesty coupled with civility. It is not enough simply to strive for accomplishment or learning. One must also recognize others' rights to strive. And that is probably the most important function the university can perform, to serve as a place where values are emphasized and lived by as an example to society at large, as a place where some freedom from the practical pressures of everyday life allows time and opportunity for more than a passing thought to such things. That is why the presence of the university on the frontier is essential, not merely to remind a new society of the value of older things, not merely to serve as a kind of frontier city in itself, but to be a home for the values which make it possible for the old and the new to interact, a place where our young people can learn the best of both these worlds so they can build the best of both these worlds into a life for the province. Finally, if this university is to serve its highest purpose, it must, in a certain sense, be BC's own frontier. Out here on Point Grey, we hope can be found that view of horizons we all need to see if we are to move with a rich awareness of where we came from towards what we can become. I thank you.
President Kenney is still obviously a professor. He turns off at exactly 50 minutes after he begins. We have time for questions and perhaps even gentle sniping. Who wants to start? Dave Freeman.
Dr. Kenney, do you think that the mechanism of control by the ambient society of a proper university is different from that in a more settled community? It's more direct and perhaps less easily deflected by the academic.
Are you asking a question basically as to whether we're more responsive to government direction and from society at large? I assume all governments are reflective in the final analysis of the public will. I suspect on the frontier we are more responsive. We have to be, because in the final analysis governments do nurture us. I think it is fair game for governments to try to influence universities, just as it is fair game for universities to resist that influence.
Yes. Yes.
I don't deny the reality of our communication world, but as I tried to briefly allude to in our speech, that most of us in the West do have a deep suspicion of the East and of the old country. If there is one common characteristic, and I do speak as a third-generation British Columbian, that we're suspicious of the East and the old, and we try to resist it as best we can, that we are proud, that we are different in many ways. I think we do take pride, as though we're Texans, of being called Mavericks. And as I understand, the word Maverick did derive from Texas, from someone down there by the name of Maverick who didn't brand his cows. We don't like to be branded.
Scholars, researchers, have their own standards. other experience within the university, accept what they've had in other universities. When they go back to Harvard, when they go back to Cambridge, it's in the international scene, and then they come back here and speak. And you say that we're just a bunch of university.
Certainly members of the community in many ways, and this is one of the tensions within a university, faculty members tend to like to view themselves as part of an international community of scholars. And that's good, and I would strongly support that. On the other hand, the society out at large is putting pressure on the university that part of our responsibility is that we do have an obligation to this province. And that was laid down at the very start of this university. And so that the Minister of Education and the government of the day tried to stress upon the university, it did have an obligation into agriculture, into mining and forestry. In fact, right up to the time of Dr. Mackenzie's day, there were only really three faculties at this university: arts and science, agriculture, and applied science. But under Dr. Mackenzie's direction, but also in response, I would argue, to the needs of British Columbians, he rapidly developed a large number of other faculties. In other words, that the main chief steward of the university was responding, and he's here tonight, and he may differ with me, in part to A, his conception of a university, but of equal importance in my analysis of the needs, the practical needs of our sons and daughters in British Columbia. And that's responding to society. We all would concede that a provincial university has a wider obligation than strictly to the province. And of course, that makes people over in Victoria a little jumpy once you start to say that, that we have national responsibilities. And usually what academicians mean when they graduate at level of turning out PhD students are engaged in a scholarship that may have some impact on Canada as a nation. Then they're likely to say, but usually with muted voices, a university has an obligation to the world, just as Canada will say it has an obligation to the world at large. And as a Canadian, I would accept that. But that I think just as governments do, you judge governments by where they put their resources. And you read the legislate sheet and you don't find too much money in Canada being devoted to the world. And that's a shame. And that's a reflection, in my mind, that we still don't have this deep sense of concern and of caring for the developing nations. We will take our hat off to a minor degree. And so all I can say is that in a frontier country, and that is Canada, that certainly people who control the resources will direct us in the first instance to respond to local, provincial needs. Secondly, to federal needs in a highly tertiary way to world needs. But the counterbalancing force on that, and it is important to understand within the university, and it will exert pressure going the other way, is that academicians will view their primary loyalty in many ways to their own world of scholarship. And that's a delicate balance, and it's worthwhile tension within the system. I'm not ducking the question.
Do you agree with that, Larry?
Sure, I agree with that.
Other questions? Yes.
For the first
becoming a mere degree factory? Does it have problems becoming a degree factory?
The question is, does the university have problems in becoming a degree factory, particularly, I guess, in a context of a frontier university? No, I really don't think it does. I think that within the system, within University of BC as a whole, we are not a degree factory by any means. And I think it is a tribute to the wider community of citizens of this province that, if anything, they don't want us to become one. That last year, some of you know that I was in what I would call limbo land. I was appointed something like 13 months before or 14 before I became president of the university. And so I wandered around the province, and one of the clearest voices that I think is being reflected in the province as a whole is, please maintain the standards of this university and don't let them slip. And as long as we maintain our standards, then I don't think we are in any danger of becoming a degree factory. Certainly those students who fail, and there are a certain number of them who do, don't feel that we are a factory. I certainly don't feel we are.
Just across the border in Montana, we have a university whose motto is education for efficiency. I don't think that's ever been the motto of this university. Other questions?
Well, the only disconcerting note is that you people don't fit my description of the frontier society.
Yes. In getting someone to thank the speaker tonight, I decided to ask Donovan Miller, who's served this university for many, many years, as much as anyone has. He's always been loyal to it. The last few days have been a difficult time for him. He's lost a ship just 2 days ago and a person working for him. But he's here tonight. We can always count on him. And I'm very glad that he's going to thank the speaker tonight. The Chancellor, Donovan Miller.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. You might think this is an inside job, and it certainly looks like it. First, the president has his vice president introduce him. He knows he's safe there. And then he has the chancellor thank him. So as you may know, he is also the vice chancellor, as well as being president. And so I'm going to be nice to him because he's going to maybe at some time have to fill in as vice chancellor in the role of the university. But this shows, I think, the close-knit team that is at this university. And as most of you are aware, our president is a very busy man in his role. He acts not only as president, and this also gives him the role of the chief executive officer of this university. And that gives him the power to generally supervise and direct the academic work of the university. On top of that, of course, he is ex officio member of all most standing committees. He's chairman of Senate, member of the Board of Governors, and member of each faculty. And on top of that, he sounds like a Marshall Dillon in a frontier town. And Mr. Marshall, we know that in this frontier village of some 23,000 students, with a large staff, that it is not the frontier village that some people think of or the frontier society. I visualize a frontier, maybe it's because I come from the prairies, as a man in overalls behind a team of horses behind a plow. And I'm not saying that Doug Kenny couldn't do that, because I'm sure he could. But here is a man with many roles to play, with a personality and the characteristics and the ability to handle these roles. On the frontier, things are tough. And in this society today, we may be like the frontier. We may not have all the material resources we would like to have, but we have tremendous raw material with which we can work the youth of the British Columbia who are at this university. And with a man like Doug Kenny to handle this job, I know that the university, under his guidance, will respond to the needs of this frontier society. So thank you very much, President Kenny.
Yes. Before you go, just a quick note about the last session of the Vancouver
graduate level of turning out PhD students are engaged in a scholarship that may have some impact on Canada as a nation. Then they're likely to say, but usually with muted voices, a university has an obligation to the world. Just as Canada will say it has an obligation to the world at large. And as a Canadian, I would accept that. But that I think just as governments do, you judge governments by where they put their resources. And you read the legislate sheet, and you don't find too much money in Canada being devoted to the world. And that's a shame. And that's a reflection, in my mind, that we still don't have this deep sense of concern and of caring for the developing nations. We will take our hat off to a minor degree. And so all I can say is that in a frontier country, and that is Canada, that certainly people who control the resources will direct us in the first instance to respond to local, provincial needs, secondly, to federal needs in a highly tertiary way to world needs. But the counterbalancing force on that, and that is important to understand within the university, and it will exert pressure going the other way, is that academicians will view their primary loyalty in many ways to their own world of scholarship. And that's a delicate balance, and it's worthwhile tension within the system. I'm not ducking the question.
Do you agree with that, Larry?
Sure, I agree with that.
Other questions? Yes. Becoming a mere degree factory? Does it have problems becoming a degree factory?
The question is, does the university have problems in becoming a degree factory, particularly, I guess, in a context of a frontier university? No, I really don't think it does. I think that within the system, within University of BC as a whole, we are not a degree factory by any means, and I think it is a tribute to the wider community of citizens of this province that, if anything, they don't want us to become one. That last year, some of you know that I was in what I would call limbo land. I was appointed something like 13 months before, or 14 before I became president of the university, and so I wandered around the province. And one of the clearest voices that I think is being reflected in the province as a whole is, please maintain the standards of this university and don't let them slip. And as long as we maintain our standards, then I don't think we are in any danger of becoming a degree factory. Certainly those students who fail, and there are a certain number of them who do, don't feel that we are a factory. I certainly don't feel we are.
Just across the border in Montana, we have a university whose motto is education for efficiency. I don't think that's ever been the motto of this university. Other questions?
Well, the only disconcerting note is that you people don't fit my description of the frontier society.
Yes. In getting someone to thank the speaker tonight, I decided to ask Donovan Miller, who's served this university for many, many years, as much as anyone has. He's always been loyal to it. The last few days have been a difficult time for him. He's lost a ship just 2 days ago and a person working for him. But he's here tonight. We can always count on him. And I'm very glad that he's going to thank the speaker tonight. The Chancellor, Donovan Miller.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. You might think this is an inside job, and it certainly looks like it. First, the president has his vice president introduce him. He knows he's safe there. And then he has the chancellor thank him. So as you may know, he is also the vice chancellor, as well as being president. And so I'm going to be nice to him because he's going to, maybe at some time, have to fill in as vice chancellor in the role of the university. But this shows, I think, the close-knit team that is at this university. And as most of you are aware, our president is a very busy man in his role. He acts not only as president, and this also gives him the role of the chief executive officer of this university, and that gives him the power to generally supervise and direct the academic work of the university. On top of that, of course, he is ex officio member of all most standing committees. He's chairman of Senate, member of the Board of Governors, and member of each faculty. And on top of that, he sounds like a Marshall Dillon in a frontier town. And Mr. Marshall, we know that in this frontier village of some 23,000 students with a large staff, that it is not the frontier village that some people think of or the frontier society. I visualize a frontier, maybe it's because I come from the prairies, as a man in overalls behind a team of horses behind a plow. And I'm not saying that Doug Kenny couldn't do that, because I'm sure he could. But here is a man with many roles to play, with the personality and the characteristics and the ability to handle these roles. On the frontier, things are tough. And in this society today, we may be like the frontier. We may not have all the material resources we would like to have, but we have tremendous raw material with which we can work. The youth of the British Columbia who are at this university. And with a man like Doug Kenny to handle this job, I know that the university, under his guidance, will respond to the needs of this frontier society. So thank you very much, President Kenny.